Lawrence, who, if not prompted, would have at once made a great noise, found himself cast into confusion by the request to play-act. He stammered a little, and said in a raised but awkwardly tentative voice, "I must see Temeraire at once, and be sure he is well." Hammond turned back at once to the attendants, spreading his hands in apology, and spoke urgently. Under their scowls, Lawrence did his best to look stern and unyielding, feeling thoroughly ridiculous and angry all at once. And eventually Hammond turned back with satisfaction and said, "Excellent! They have agreed to take us to him." Relieved, Lawrence nodded and turned back to the ship's crew. "Mr. Tripp, let these gentlemen show you and the men where to sleep. I will speak with you in the morning before you return to the Allegiance," he told the midshipman, who touched his hat, and then he climbed up onto the stairs. Without discussion, Granby arranged the men in a loose formation around him as they walked along the broad, paved roads, following the guide's bobbing lantern. Lawrence had the impression of many small houses on either side, and deep wheel ruts were cut into the paving stones, all sharp edges worn soft and curving with the impression of long years. He felt wide awake after the long day drowsing, and yet there was something curiously dreamlike about walking through the foreign dark, the soft black boots of the guide making hushing noises over the stones, the smoke of cooking fires drifting from the nearby houses, muted light filtering from behind screens and out of windows, and once a snatch of unfamiliar song in a woman's voice. They came at last to the end of the wide, straight road, and the guide led them up the broad stairway of a pavilion, and between massive round columns of painted wood, the roof so far overhead that its shape was lost in the darkness. The low, rumbled breathing of dragons echoed loudly in the half-enclosed space, close all around them, and the tawny lantern light gleamed on scales in every direction, like heaped mounds of treasure around the narrow aisle through the centre. Hammond drew unconsciously closer to the centre of their party, and caught his breath once, as the lantern reflected from a dragon's half-open eye, turning into a disk of flat, shining gold. They passed through another set of columns and into an open garden, with water trickling somewhere in the darkness, and the whisper of broad leaves rubbing against one another overhead. A few more dragons lay sleeping here, one sprawled across the path. The guide poked him with a stick of the lantern until he grudgingly moved away, never even opening his eyes. They climbed more stairs up to another pavilion, smaller than the first, and here at last found Temeraire curled up alone in the echoing vastness. "Lawrence," Temeraire said, lifting his head as they came in, and nuzzled at him gladly. "Will you stay? It is very strange to be sleeping on land again. I almost feel as though the ground is moving."
"Of course," Lawrence said, and the crew laid themselves down without complaint. The night was pleasantly warm, and the floor made of inlaid squares of wood, smoothed down by years, and not uncomfortably hard. Lawrence took his usual place upon Temeraire's forearm. After sleeping through the journey, he was wakeful, and told Granby he would take the first watch. "Have you been given something to eat?" he asked Temeraire, once they were settled.
"Oh, yes," Temeraire said drowsily. "A roast pig, very large, and some stewed mushrooms. I am not at all hungry. It was not a very difficult flight, after all, and nothing very interesting either to see before the sun went down, except those fields were strange that we came past, full of water."
"The rice fields," Lawrence said.
But Temeraire was already asleep, and shortly began to snore. The noise was decidedly louder in the confines of the pavilion, even though it had no walls. The night was very dark, and the mosquitoes were not too much of a torment, thankfully. They evidently did not care for the dry heat given off by a dragon's body. There was very little to mark the time, with the sky concealed by the roof, and Lawrence lost track of the hours. No interruption in the stillness of the night, except that once a noise in the courtyard drew his attention, a dragon landing, turning a milky, pearlescent gaze towards them, reflecting the moonlight very much like a cat's eyes. But it did not come near the pavilion, and only padded away deeper into the darkness. Granby woke for his turn at watch. Lawrence composed himself to sleep. He, too, felt the old, familiar illusion of the earth shifting, his body remembering the movement of the ocean even now that they had left it behind. He woke, startled.
The riot of colour overhead was strange until he understood he was looking at the decoration upon the ceiling, every scrap of wood painted and enamelled in brilliant peacocky colours and shining gilt. He sat up and looked about himself with fresh interest. The round columns were painted a solid red, set upon square bases of white marble, and the roof was at least 30 feet overhead. Temeraire would have had no difficulty coming in underneath it. The front of the pavilion opened onto a prospect of the courtyard, which he found interesting rather than beautiful. Paved with grey stones around a winding path of reddish ones, full of queerly shaped rocks and trees, and, of course, dragons. There were 5 sprawled over the grounds in various attitudes of repose, except for one already awake and grooming itself fastidiously by the enormous pool which covered the northeast corner of the grounds. The dragon was a shade of greyish-blue, not very different from the present colour of the sky, and curiously the tips of its 4 claws were painted a bright red. As Lawrence watched, it finished its morning ablutions and took to the air. Most of the dragons in the yard seemed of a similar breed, though there was a great deal of variety among them in size, in the precise shade of their colour, and in the number and placement of their horns. Some were smooth-backed, and others had spiked ridges. Shortly a very different kind of dragon came out of the large pavilion to the south, larger and crimson-red, with gold-tinted talons and a bright yellow crest running from its many-horned head and along its spine. It drank from the pool and yawned enormously, displaying a double row of small but wicked teeth and a set of 4 larger curving fangs among them. Narrower halls, with walls interspersed with small archways, ran to east and west of the courtyard, joining the 2 pavilions. The red dragon went over to one of the archways now and yelled something inside. A few moments later, a woman came stumbling out through the archway, rubbing her face and making wordless, groaning noises. Lawrence stared, then looked away, embarrassed. She was naked to the waist. The dragon nudged her hard and knocked her back entirely into the pond. It certainly had a reviving effect. She rose up, spluttering and wide-eyed, and then yammered back at the grinning dragon in a passion before going back inside the hall. She came out again a few minutes later, now fully dressed in what seemed to be a sort of padded jerkin, dark blue cotton edged with broad bands of red, with wide sleeves, and carrying a rig made also of fabric. Silk, Lawrence thought. This she threw upon the dragon all by herself, still talking loudly and obviously disgruntled all the while. Lawrence was irresistibly reminded of Berkeley and Maximus, even though Berkeley had never spoken so many words together in his life. Something in the irreverent quality of their relations. The rig secured, the Chinese aviator scrambled aboard and the 2 went aloft with no further ceremony, disappearing from the pavilion to whatever their day's duties might be. All the dragons were now beginning to stir, another 3 of the big scarlet ones coming out of the pavilion, and more people to come from the halls, men from the east and a few more women from the west. Temeraire himself twitched under Lawrence and then opened his eyes.
"Good morning," he said, yawning.
Then,
"Oh!"
His eyes wide as he looked around, taking in the opulent decoration and the bustle going on in the courtyard.
"I did not realize there were so many other dragons here, or that it was so grand," he said a little nervously. "I hope they are friendly."
"I am sure they cannot but be gracious, when they realize you have come from so far," Lawrence said, climbing down so Temeraire could stand.
The air was close and heavy with moisture, the sky remaining uncertain and grey. It would be hot again, he thought.
"You ought to drink as much as you can," he said. "I have no notion how often they will want to stop and rest along the way today."
"I suppose,"
Temeraire said reluctantly, and stepped out of the pavilion and into the court. The increasing hubbub came to an abrupt and complete halt. The dragons and their companions alike stared openly, and then there was a general movement back and away from him. Lawrence was for a moment shocked and offended. Then he saw that they were all, men and dragons, bowing themselves very low to the ground. They had only been opening a clear path to the pond. There was perfect silence. Temeraire uncertainly walked through the parted ranks of the other dragons to the pond, rather hastily drank his fill, and retreated to the raised pavilion. Only when he had gone again did the general activity resume, with much less noise than earlier, and a good deal of peering into the pavilion, while pretending to do nothing of the sort.
"They were very nice to let me drink,"
Temeraire said, almost whispering.
"But I wish they would not stare so."
The dragons seemed disposed to linger, but one after another they all set off, except for a few plainly older ones, their scales faded at the edges, who returned to basking upon the courtyard stones. Granby and the rest of the crew had woken over the intervening time, sitting up to watch the spectacle with as much interest as the other dragons had taken in Temeraire. Now they roused fully and began to straighten their clothing.
"I suppose they will send someone for us," Hammond was saying, brushing futilely at his wrinkled breeches.
He had been dressed formally, rather than in the riding gear which all the aviators had put on. At that very moment, Ye Bing, one of the young Chinese attendants from the ship, came through the courtyard, waving to draw their attention. Breakfast was not what Lawrence was used to, being a sort of thin rice porridge mixed with dried fish and slices of horrifically discoloured eggs, served with greasy sticks of crisp, very light bread. The eggs he pushed to the side and forced himself to eat the rest, on the same advice which he had given to Temeraire, but he would have given a great deal for some properly cooked eggs and bacon. Liu Bao poked Lawrence in the arm with his chopsticks and pointed at the eggs with some remark. He was eating his own with very evident relish.
"What do you suppose is the matter with them?"
Granby asked in an undertone, prodding his own eggs doubtfully. Hammond, inquiring of Liu Bao, said just as doubtfully,
"He says they are 1,000-year eggs."
Braver than the rest of them, he picked one of the slices up and ate it, chewed, swallowed, and looked thoughtful while they waited his verdict.
"It tastes almost pickled," he said. "Not rotten, at any rate."
He tried another piece and ended by eating the whole serving. For his own part, Lawrence left the lurid yellow and green things alone. They had been brought to a sort of guest hall, not far from the Dragon Pavilion, for the meal. The sailors were there waiting and joined them for the breakfast, grinning rather maliciously. They were no more pleased at being left out of the adventure than the rest of the aviators had been, and not above making remarks about the quality of food which the party could expect for the rest of their journey. Afterwards, Lawrence took his final parting from Trip.
"And be sure you tell Captain Riley that all is ship-shape, in those exact words," he said.
It had been arranged between them that any other message, regardless how reassuring, would mean something had gone badly wrong. A couple of mule-led carts were waiting for them outside, rather rough-hewn and clearly without springs. Their baggage had gone on ahead. Lawrence climbed in and held on grimly to the side as they rattled along down the road. The streets, at least, were not more impressive by daylight, very broad but paved with old, rounded cobblestones whose mortar had largely worn away. The wheels of the cart ran along in deep, sloping ruts between stones, bumping and leaping over the uneven surface. There was a bustle of people all around, who stared with great curiosity at them, often putting down their work to follow after them for some short distance.
"And this is not even a city?"
Granby looked around with interest, making some attempt to tally the numbers.
"There seem to be a great many people for only a town."
"There are some 200 millions of people in the country by our latest intelligence,"
Hammond said absently, himself busy taking down notes in a journal. Lawrence shook his head at the appalling number, more than 10 times the size of England's population. Lawrence was more startled for his part to see a dragon come walking down the road in the opposite direction, another of the blue-grey ones. It was wearing a queer sort of silk harness with a prominent breast-pad, and when they had passed it by, he saw that 3 little dragonettes, 2 of the same variety and 1 of the red colour, were tramping along behind, each attached to the harness also, as if on leading strings. Nor was this dragon the only one in the streets. They shortly passed by a military station, with a small troop of blue-clad infantrymen drilling in its courtyard, and a couple of the big red dragons were sitting outside the gate talking and exclaiming over a dice game which their captains were playing. No one seemed to take any particular notice of them. The hurrying peasants carrying their loads went by without a second glance, occasionally climbing over one of the splayed-out limbs when other routes were blocked. Temeraire was waiting for them in an open field, with 2 of the blue-grey dragons also on hand, wearing mesh harnesses which were being loaded up with baggage by attendants. The other dragons were whispering amongst themselves and eyeing Temeraire sidelong. He looked uncomfortable and greatly relieved to see Lawrence. Having been loaded, the dragons now crouched down onto all fours, so the attendants could climb aloft and raise small pavilions on their backs, very much like the tents which were used for long flights among British aviators. One of the attendants spoke to Hammond and gestured to one of the blue dragons. "We are to ride on that one," Hammond said to Lawrence aside, then asked something else of the attendant, who shook his head, and answered forcefully, pointing again to the second dragon. Before the reply could even be translated, Temeraire sat up indignantly.
"Lawrence is not riding any other dragon," he said, putting out a possessive claw and nearly knocking Lawrence off his feet, herding him closer.
Hammond scarcely had to repeat the sentiments in Chinese. Lawrence had not quite realized the Chinese did not mean for even him to ride with Temeraire. He did not like the idea of Temeraire having to fly with no company on the long trip, and yet he could not help but think the point a small one. They would be flying in company, in sight of one another, and Temeraire could be in no real danger.
"It is only for the one journey," he said to Temeraire,
and was surprised to find himself overruled at once, not by Temeraire, but by Hammond.
"Nope, the suggestion is unacceptable, cannot be entertained,"
Hammond said.
"Not at all,"
Temeraire said, in perfect agreement, and actually growled when the attendant tried to continue the argument.
"Mr. Hammond," Lawrence said with happy inspiration,
"pray tell them, if it is the notion of harness which is at issue, I can just as easily lock on to the chain of Temeraire's pendant. As long as I do not need to go climbing about, it will be secure enough."
"They cannot possibly argue with that,"
Temeraire said, pleased, and interrupted the argument immediately to make the suggestion, which was grudgingly accepted.
"Captain, may I have a word?"
Hammond drew him aside.
"This attempt is of a piece with last night's arrangements. I must urge you, sir, by no means agree to continue on, should we somehow come to be parted, and be on your guard if they should make further attempts to separate you from Temeraire."
"I take your point, sir, and thank you for the advice," Lawrence said grimly, and looked narrowly at Yong Xing.
Though the prince had never stooped to involve himself directly in any of the discussions, Lawrence suspected his hand behind them, and he had hoped that the failure of the shipboard attempts to part them would at least have precluded these efforts. After these tensions at the journey's outset, the long day's flight itself was uneventful, except for the occasional leap in Lawrence's stomach when Temeraire would swoop down for a closer look at the ground. The breastplate did not keep entirely still throughout the flight and shifted far more than harness. Temeraire was considerably quicker than the other two dragons, with more endurance, and could easily catch them up even if he lingered half an hour in sightseeing at a time. The most striking feature to Lawrence was the exuberance of the population. They scarcely passed any long stretch of land that was not under cultivation of some form, and every substantial body of water was crammed full of boats going either direction. And, of course, the real immensity of the country. They travelled from morning to night, with only an hour's pause for dinner each day at noon. And the days were long. An almost endless expanse of broad, flat plains, checkered with rice fields and interspersed with many streams, yielded after some 2 days' travel to hills, and then to the slow, puckering rise of mountains. Towns and villages of varying size punctuated the countryside below, and occasionally people working in the fields would stop and watch them flying overhead if Temeraire came low enough to be recognized as a celestial. Lawrence at first thought the Yangtze another lake, one of respectable size but not extraordinary, being something less than a mile wide, with its east and west banks shrouded in a fine grey drizzle. Only when they had come properly overhead could he see the mighty river sprawling endlessly away, and the slow procession of junks appearing and vanishing through the mists. After having passed 2 nights in smaller towns, Lawrence had begun to think their first establishment an unusual case, but their residence that night in the city of Wuchang dwarfed it into insignificance. 8 great pavilions arranged in a symmetric octagonal shape, joined by narrower enclosed halls around a space deserving to be called a park more than a garden. Roland and Dyer made at first a game of trying to count the dragons inhabiting it, but gave up the attempt somewhere after 30. They lost track of their tally when a group of small purple dragons landed and darted in a flurry of wings and limbs across the pavilion, too many and too quick to count. Temeraire drowsed. Lawrence put aside his bowl, another plain dinner of rice and vegetables. Most of the men were already asleep, huddled in their cloaks, the rest silent. Rain still coming down in a steady, steaming curtain beyond the walls of the pavilion, the overrun clattering off the upturned corners of the tiled roof. Along the slopes of the river valley, faintly visible, small yellow beacons burnt beneath open-walled huts to mark the way for dragons flying through the night. Soft, grumbling breath echoing from the neighbouring pavilions, and far away a more piercing cry, ringing clear despite the muffling weight of the rain. Yongxing had been spending his nights apart from the rest of the company in more private quarters, but now he came out of seclusion and stood at the edge of the pavilion, looking out into the valley. In another moment the call came again, nearer. Temeraire lifted up his head to listen, the ruff around his neck rising up alertly. Then Lawrence heard the familiar leathery snapping of wings, mist and steam rolling away from the stones for the descending dragon, a white ghostly shadow coalescing from the silver rain. She folded great white wings and came pacing towards them, her talons clicking on the stones. The attendants, going between pavilions, shrank away from her, averting their faces, hurrying by. But Yongxing walked down the steps into the rain, and she lowered her great, wide-ruffed head towards him, calling his name in a clear, sweet voice.
"Is that another celestial?" Temeraire asked him, hushed and uncertain.
Lawrence only shook his head and could not answer. She was shockingly pure white, a colour he had never before seen in a dragon, even in spots or streaks. Her scales had the translucent gleam of fine, much-scraped vellum, perfectly colourless, and the rims of her eyes were a glassy pink, mazed with blood vessels so engorged as to be visible even at a distance. Yet she had the same great ruff, and the long, narrow tendrils fringing her jaws just as Temeraire did. The colour alone was unnatural.
She wore a heavy golden torque set with rubies around the base of her neck, and gold talon sheaths tipped with rubies upon all of her foreleg claws, the deep colour echoing the hue of her eyes.
She nudged Yongxing caressingly back into the shelter of the temple and came in after him, first shivering her wings quickly to let cascades of rain roll away in streams. She allotted them barely a glance, her eyes flickering rapidly over them and away, before she jealously coiled herself around Yongxing to murmur quietly with him in the far corner of the pavilion. Servants came bringing her some dinner, but dragging their heels uneasily, though they had shown no such similar reluctance around any of the other dragons, and indeed visible satisfaction in Temeraire's presence. She did not seem to merit their fear. She ate quickly and daintily, not letting so much as a drop spill out of the dish, and otherwise paid them no mind. The next morning, Yongxing briefly presented her to them as Lung Tien Lien, and then led her away to breakfast in private. Hammond had made quiet inquiries enough to tell them a little more over their own meal.
"She is certainly a celestial," he said. "I suppose it is a kind of albinism. I have no idea why it should make them all so uneasy."
"She was born in morning colours. Of course she is unlucky," Liu Bao said,
when he was cautiously applied to for information, as if this were self-evident, and he added,
"The Qianlong Emperor was going to give her to a prince out in Mongolia, so her bad luck wouldn't hurt any of his sons. But Yongxing insisted on having her himself, instead of letting a celestial go outside the imperial family. He could have been emperor himself, but of course you couldn't have an emperor with a cursed dragon. It would be a disaster for the state. So now his brother is the Jieqing Emperor. Such is the will of heaven."
With this philosophical remark he shrugged and ate another piece of fried bread. Hammond took this news bleakly, and Lawrence shared his dismay. Pride was one thing, principle implacable enough to sacrifice a throne for something else entirely. The two bearer dragons accompanying them had been changed for another one of the blue-grey breed and one of a slightly larger kind, deep green with blue streaks and a sleek, hornless head. They still regarded Temeraire with the same staring awe, however, and Lien with nervous respect, and kept well to themselves. Temeraire had by now reconciled himself to the state of majestic solitude, and in any case he was thoroughly occupied in glancing sidelong at Lien with fascinated curiosity, until she turned to stare pointedly at him in return, and he ducked his head, abashed. She wore this morning an odd sort of headdress, made of thin silk draped between gold bars, which stood out over her eyes rather like a canopy, and shaded them. Lawrence wondered that she should find it necessary with the sky still unrelieved and grey. But the hot, sullen weather broke almost abruptly during their first few hours of flight, through gorges winding among old mountains, their sloping southern faces lush and green, and the northern almost barren. A cool wind met their faces as they came out into the foothills, and the sun, breaking from the clouds, was almost painfully bright. The rice fields did not reappear, but long expanses of ripening wheat took their place, and once they saw a great herd of brown oxen creeping slowly across a grassy plain, heads to the ground as they munched away. A little shed was planted on a hill, overlooking the herd, and beside it several massive spits turned, entire cows roasting upon them, a fragrant, smoky smell rising upwards.
"Those look tasty," Temeraire observed, a little wistfully.
He was not alone in the sentiment. As they approached, one of their companion dragons put on a sudden burst of speed and swooped down. A man came out of the shed and held a discussion with the dragon, then went inside again. He came out carrying a large plank of wood, and laid it down before the dragon, which carved a few Chinese symbols into the plank with its talon. The man took away the plank, and the dragon took away a cow. Plainly, it had been making a purchase. It lifted back up into the air at once to rejoin them, crunching its cow happily as it flew. It evidently did not think it necessary to let its passengers off for any of the proceedings. Lawrence thought he could see poor Hammond looking faintly green as it slurped the intestines up with obvious pleasure.
"We could try to purchase one, if they will take guineas," Lawrence offered to Temeraire, a little dubiously.
He had brought gold rather than paper money with him, but had no idea if the herdsman would accept it.
"Oh, I am not really hungry,"
Temeraire said, preoccupied by a wholly different thought.
"Lawrence, that was writing, was it not? What he did on the plank?"
"I believe so, though I do not set myself up as an expert on Chinese writing," Lawrence said. "You are more likely to recognize it than I."
"I wonder if all Chinese dragons know how to write,"
Temeraire said, dismal at the notion.
"They will think me very stupid if I am the only one who cannot. I must learn somehow. I always thought letters had to be made with a pen, but I am sure I could do that sort of carving."
Perhaps in courtesy to Lien, who seemed to dislike bright sunlight, they now paused during the heat of the day at another wayside pavilion for some dinner, and for the dragons to rest, and flew on into the evening instead. Beacons upon the ground lit their way at irregular intervals, and in any case Lawrence could chart their course by the stars, turning now more sharply to the northeast, with the miles slipping quickly past. The days continued hot, but no longer so extraordinarily humid, and the nights were wonderfully cool and pleasant. Signs of the force of the northern winters were apparent, however. The pavilions were walled on three sides and set up from the ground on stone platforms which held stoves, so the floors could be heated. Peking sprawled out a great distance from beyond the city walls, which were numerous and grand, with many square towers and battlements not unlike the style of European castles. Broad streets of grey stone ran in straight lines to the gates, and within, so full of people, of horses, of carts, all of them moving, that from above they seemed like rivers. They saw many dragons also, both on the streets and in the sky, leaping into the air for short flights from one quarter of the city to another, sometimes with a crowd of people hanging off them, and evidently travelling in this manner. The city was divided with extraordinary regularity into square sections, except for the curving sprawl of four small lakes actually within the walls. To the east of these lay the great imperial palace itself, not a single building, but formed of many smaller pavilions, walled in and surrounded by a moat of murky water. In the setting sun, all the roofs within the complex shone as if gilded, nestled among trees with their spring growth still fresh and yellow-green, throwing long shadows into the plazas of grey stone. A smaller dragon met them in mid-air as they drew near. Black, with canary-yellow stripes, and wearing a collar of dark green silk, he had a rider upon his back, but spoke to the other dragons directly. Temeraire followed the other dragons down to a small round island in the southernmost lake, less than half a mile from the palace walls. They landed upon a broad pier of white marble which jutted out into the lake, for the convenience of dragons only, as there were no boats in evidence. This pier ended in an enormous gateway, a red structure, more than a wall, and yet too narrow to be considered a building, with three square archways as openings, the two smallest many times higher than Temeraire's head, and wide enough for four of him to walk abreast. The central was even larger. A pair of enormous imperial dragons stood at attention on either side, very like Temeraire in conformity, but without his distinctive ruff, one black and the other a deep blue, and beside them a long file of soldiers, infantrymen in shining steel caps and blue robes with long spears. The two companion dragons walked directly through the smaller archways, and Lien paced straight away through the middle, but the yellow-striped dragon barred Temeraire from following, bowed low, and said something in apologetic tones while gesturing to the centre archway. Temeraire answered back shortly, and sat down on his haunches with an air of finality, his ruff stiff and laid back against his neck in obvious displeasure. "Is something wrong?" Lawrence asked quietly. Through the archway he could see a great many people and dragons assembled in the courtyard beyond, and obviously some ceremony was intended.
"They want you to climb down and go through one of the small archways, and for me to go through the large one," Temeraire said. "But I am not putting you down alone. It sounds very silly to me, anyway, to have three doors all going to the same place."
Lawrence wished rather desperately for Hammond's advice, or anyone's for that matter. The striped dragon and his rider were equally nonplussed at Temeraire's recalcitrance, and Lawrence found himself looking at the other man and meeting with an almost identical expression of confusion. The dragons and soldiers in the archway remained as motionless and precise as statues. But as the minutes passed, those assembled on the other side must have come to realize something was wrong. A man in richly embroidered blue robes came hurrying through the side corridor and spoke to the striped dragon and his rider, then looked askance at Lawrence and Temeraire, and hurried back to the other side. A low murmur of conversation began, echoing down the archway, then was abruptly cut off. The people on the far side parted, and a dragon came through the archway towards them, a deep glossy black, very much like Temeraire's own colouring, with the same deep blue eyes and wing markings, and a great standing ruff of translucent black, stretched among ribbed horns of a million. Another celestial. She stopped before them and spoke in deep, resonant tones. Lawrence felt Temeraire first stiffen and then tremble, his own ruff rising slowly up. And Temeraire said, low and uncertainly,
"Lawrence, this is my mother."
Chapter 13. Lawrence later learned from Hammond that passage through the central gate was reserved for the use of the imperial family and dragons of that breed and the celestials only, hence their refusal to let Lawrence himself pass through. At the moment, however, Tian simply led Temeraire in a short flight over the gateway and into the central courtyard beyond, thus neatly severing the Gordian knot. The problem of etiquette resolved, they were all ushered into an enormous banquet, held within the largest of the dragon pavilions, with two tables waiting. Tian was herself seated at the head of the first table, with Temeraire upon her left, and Yongxing and Lien upon her right. Lawrence was directed to sit some distance down the table, with Hammond across, and several more seats down. The rest of the British party was placed at the second table. Lawrence did not think it politic to object. The separation was not even the length of the room, and in any case Temeraire's attention was entirely engaged at present. He was speaking to his mother with an almost timid air, very unlike himself and clearly overawed. She was larger than he, and the faint translucence of her scales indicated a great age, as did her very grand manners. She wore no harness, but her ruff was adorned with enormous yellow topazes affixed to the spines, and a deceptively fragile neckpiece of filigree gold studded with more topazes and great pearls. Truly gigantic platters of brass were set before the dragons, each bearing an entire roasted deer, antlers intact. Oranges stuck with cloves were impaled upon them, creating a fragrance not at all unpleasant to human senses, and their bellies were stuffed with a mixture of nuts and very bright red berries. The humans were served with a sequence of 8 dishes, smaller though equally elaborate. After the dismal food along the course of the journey, even the highly exotic repast was very welcome, however. Lawrence had assumed there should be no one for him to talk to as he sat down, unless he tried to shout across to Hammond, there being no translator present so far as he could tell. On his left side sat a very old mandarin, wearing a hat with a pearlescent white jewel perched on top, and a peacock feather dangling down from the back over a truly impressive queue, still mostly black despite the profusion of wrinkles engraved upon his face. He ate and drank with single-minded intensity, never even trying to address Lawrence at all. When the neighbour on his other side leaned over and shouted in the man's ear, Lawrence realised that he was very deaf, as well as being unable to speak English. But shortly after he had seated himself, he was taken aback to be addressed from his other side in English, heavy with French accents.
"I hope you have had a comfortable journey," said the smiling, cheerful voice.
It was the French ambassador, dressed in long robes in the Chinese style rather than in European dress. That and his dark hair accounted for Lawrence not having distinguished him at once from the rest of the company.
"You will permit that I make myself known to you, I hope, despite the unhappy state of affairs between our countries," de Guignes continued. "I can claim an informal acquaintance, you see. My nephew tells me he owes his life to your magnanimity."
"I beg your pardon, sir. I have not the least notion to what you refer,"
Lawrence said, puzzled by this address.
"Your nephew?"
"Jean-Claude de Guignes. He is a lieutenant in our Armée de l'Air,"
the ambassador said, bowing, still smiling.
"You encountered him this last November over your channel, when he made an attempt to board you."
"Good God!"
Lawrence said, exclaiming, distantly recalling the young lieutenant who had fought so vigorously in the convoy action, and he willingly shook de Guignes' hand.
"I remember. Most extraordinary courage. I am so very happy to hear that he is quite recovered, I hope."
"Oh, yes. In his letter he expected to rise from his hospital any day. To go to prison, of course, but that is better than going to a grave," de Guignes said, with a prosaic shrug. "He wrote me of your interesting journey, knowing I had been dispatched here to your destination. I have been with great pleasure expecting you this last month, since his letter arrived, with hopes of expressing my admiration for your generosity."
From this happy beginning, they exchanged some more conversation on neutral topics, the Chinese climate, the food, and the startling number of dragons. Lawrence could not help but feel a certain kinship with him, as a fellow Westerner in the depths of the Oriental enclave, and though de Guignes was himself not a military man, his familiarity with the French aerial corps made him sympathetic company. They walked out together at the close of the meal, following the other guests into the courtyard, where most of these were being carried away by dragon in the same manner they had seen earlier in the city.
"It is a clever mode of transport, is it not?"
de Guignes said, and Lawrence, watching with interest, agreed wholeheartedly. The dragons, mostly of what he now considered the common blue variety, wore light harnesses of many silk straps draped over their backs, to which were hung numerous loops of broad silk ribbons. The passengers climbed up the loops to the topmost empty one, which they slid down over their arms and underneath the buttocks. They could then sit in comparative stability, clinging to the main strap, so long as the dragon flew level. Hammond emerged from the pavilion and caught sight of them, eyes widening, and hastened to join them. He and de Guignes smiled and spoke with great friendliness, and as soon as the Frenchman had excused himself and departed in company with a pair of Chinese mandarins, Hammond instantly turned to Lawrence and demanded, in a perfectly shameless manner, to have the whole of their conversation recounted.
"Expecting us for a month?"
Hammond was appalled by the intelligence, and managed to imply, without actually saying anything openly offensive, that he thought Lawrence had been a simpleton to take De Guigne at face value.
"God only knows what mischief he may have worked against us in that time. Pray have no more private conversation with him."
Lawrence did not respond to these remarks, as he rather wanted to, and instead went away to Temeraire's side. Chian had been the last to depart, taking a caressing leave of Temeraire, nudging him with her nose before leaping aloft.
Her sleek, black form disappeared into the night quickly, and Temeraire stood watching after her very wistfully.
The island had been prepared for their residence as a compromise measure. The property of the Emperor, it possessed several large and elegant dragon pavilions, with establishments intended for human use conjoined to these. Lawrence and his party were allowed to establish themselves in a residence attached to the largest of the pavilions, facing across a broad courtyard. The building was a handsome one, and large, but the upper floor was wholly taken up by a host of servants greatly exceeding their needs. Although seeing how these ranged themselves almost underfoot throughout the house, Lawrence began to suspect they were intended equally as spies and guards. His sleep was heavy, but broken before dawn by servants poking their heads in to see if he were awake. After the fourth such attempt in 10 minutes, Lawrence yielded with no good grace and rose with a head still aching from the previous day's free flow of wine. He had little success in conveying his desire for a wash-basin, and at length resorted to stepping outside into the courtyard to wash in the pond there. This posed no difficulty, as there was an enormous circular window, little less than his height, set in the wall, the lower sill barely off the ground. Temeraire was sprawled luxuriously across the far end, lying flattened upon his belly, with even his tail stretched out to its full extent, still fast asleep, and making occasional small, pleased grunts as he dreamed. A system of bamboo pipes emerged from beneath the pavement, evidently used to heat the stones, and these spilled a cloud of hot water into the pond, so Lawrence could make more comfortable ablutions than he had expected. The servants hovered in visible impatience all the time, and looked rather scandalized at his stripping to the waist to wash. When at last he came back in, they pressed Chinese dress upon him, soft trousers and the stiff collared gown which seemed nearly universal among them. He resisted a moment, but a glance over at his own clothes showed them sadly wrinkled from the travel. The native dress was at least neat, if not what he was used to, and not physically uncomfortable, though he felt very nearly indecent without a proper coat or neckcloth. A functionary of some sort had come to breakfast with them and was already waiting at table, which was evidently the source of the servant's urgency. Lawrence bowed rather shortly to the stranger named Zhao Wei, and let Hammond carry the conversation while he drank a great deal of the tea. Fragrant and strong, but not a dish of milk to be seen, and the servants only looked blank when the request was translated for them.
"His Imperial Majesty has in his benevolence decreed you are to reside here for the length of your visit,"
Zhao Wei was saying. His English was by no means polished, but understandable. He had a rather prim and pinched look, and eyed Lawrence's still unskilled use of the chopsticks with an expression of disdain hovering about his mouth.
"You may walk in the courtyard as you desire, but you are not to leave the residence without making a formal request and receiving permission."
"Sir, we are most grateful, but you must be aware that if we are not to be allowed free movement during the day, the size of this house is by no means adequate to our needs," Hammond said. "Why, only Captain Lawrence and myself had private rooms last night, and those small and ill-befitting our standing, while the rest of our compatriots were housed in shared quarters and very cramped."
Lawrence had noticed no such inadequacy, and found both the attempted restrictions on their movement and Hammond's negotiations for more space mildly absurd, the more so as it transpired from their conversation that the whole of the island had been vacated in deference to Temeraire. The complex could have accommodated a dozen dragons in extreme comfort, and there were sufficient human residences that every man of Lawrence's crew might have had a building to himself. Still, their residence was in perfectly good repair, comfortable, and far more spacious than their shipboard quarters for the last 7 months. He could not see the least reason for desiring additional space any more than for denying them the liberty of the island. But Hammond and Zhao Wei continued to negotiate the matter with a measured gravity and politeness. Zhao Wei at length consented to their being allowed to take walks around the island in the company of the servants.
"So long as you do not go to the shores or the docks, and do not interfere in the patrols of the guardsmen."
With this, Hammond pronounced himself satisfied. Zhao Wei sipped at his tea and then added,
"Of course, His Majesty wishes Long Tian Chiang to see something of the city. I will conduct him upon a tour after he has eaten."
"I am certain Temeraire and Captain Lawrence will find it most edifying," Hammond said immediately, before Lawrence could even draw breath. "Indeed, sir, it was very kind of you to arrange for native clothing for Captain Lawrence, so he will not suffer from excessive curiosity." Zhao Wei only now took notice of Lawrence's clothing, with an expression that made it perfectly plain he was nothing whatsoever involved. But he bore his defeat in reasonably good part. He said only,
"I hope you will be ready to leave shortly, Captain,"
with a small inclination of the head.
"And we may walk through the city itself?"
Temeraire asked, with much excitement, as he was scrubbed and sluiced clean after his breakfast, holding out his forehands one at a time, with the talons outspread, to be brushed vigorously with soapy water. His teeth even received the same treatment, a young serving maid ducking inside his mouth to scrub the back ones.
"Of course,"
Zhao Wei said, showing some sincere puzzlement at the question.
"Perhaps you may see something of the training grounds of the dragons here, if there are any within the city bounds,"
Hammond suggested. He had accompanied them outside.
"I am sure you would find it of interest, Temeraire."
"Oh, yes,"
Temeraire said. His ruff was already up and half quivering. Hammond gave Lawrence a significant glance, but Lawrence chose to ignore it entirely. He had little desire to play the spy, or to prolong the tour, however interesting the sights might be.
"Are you quite ready, Temeraire?" he asked instead.
They were transported to the shore by an elaborate but awkward barge, which wallowed uncertainly under Temeraire's weight, even in the placidity of the tiny lake. Lawrence kept close to the tiller and watched the lubberly pilot with a grim and censorious eye. He would dearly have loved to take her away from the fellow. The scant distance to shore took twice as long to cover as it ought to have. A substantial escort of armed guards had been detached from their patrols on the island to accompany them on the tour. Most of these fanned out ahead to force a clear path through the streets, but some 10 kept close on Lawrence's heels, jostling one another out of any kind of formation in what seemed to be an attempt to keep him blocked almost by a human wall from wandering away. Zhao Wei took them through another of the elaborate red and gold gateways, this one set in a fortified wall and yielding onto a very broad avenue. It was manned by several guards in the imperial livery, as well as by 2 dragons also under gear. One of the, by now familiar, red ones, and the other a brilliant green with red markings. Their captains were sitting together, sipping tea under an awning, their padded jerkins removed against the day's heat, and both were women.
"I see you have women captains also," Lawrence said to Zhao Wei. "Do they serve with particular breeds, then?"
"Women are companions to those dragons who go into the army," Zhao Wei said. "Naturally, only the lower breeds would choose to do that sort of work. Over there, that green one is one of the emerald glass. They are too lazy and slow to do well on the examinations, and the scarlet flower breed all like fighting too much, so they are not good for anything else."
"Do you mean to say that only women serve in your aerial corps?"
Lawrence asked, sure he had misunderstood. Yet Zhao Wei only nodded a confirmation.
"But what reason can there be for such a policy? Surely you do not ask women to serve in your infantry or navy,"
Lawrence protested. His dismay was evident, and Zhao Wei, perhaps feeling a need to defend his nation's unusual practice, proceeded to narrate the legend which was its foundation. The details were, of course, romanticized. A girl had supposedly disguised herself as a man to fight in her father's stead, had become companion to a military dragon, and saved the empire by winning a great battle. As a consequence, the emperor of the time had pronounced girls acceptable for service with dragons. But these colourful exaggerations aside, it seemed that the nation's policy itself was accurately described. In times of conscription, the head of each family had at one time been required to serve or send a child in his stead. Girls being considerably less valued than boys, they had become the preferred choice to fill out the quota when possible. As they could only serve in the aerial corps, They had come to dominate this branch of the service until eventually the force became exclusive. The telling of the legend, complete with recitation of its traditional poetic version, which Lawrence suspected lost a great deal of colour in the translation, carried them past the gate and some distance along the avenue towards a broad, grey-flagged plaza set back from the road itself and full of children and hatchlings. The boys sat cross-legged on the floor in front, the hatchlings coiled up neatly behind, and all together in a queer mixture of childish voices and the more resonant draconic tones were parroting a human teacher who stood on a podium in front, reading loudly from a great book and beckoning the students to repeat after every line. Zhao Wei waved his hand towards them.
"You wanted to see our schools. This is a new class, of course. They are only just beginning to study the Analects."
Lawrence was privately baffled at the notion of subjecting dragons to study and written examinations.
"They do not seem paired off," he said, studying the group.
Zhao Wei looked blankly at him, and Lawrence clarified.
"I mean, the boys are not sitting with their own hatchlings, and the children seem rather young for them, indeed."
"Oh, those dragonettes are much too young to have chosen any companions yet," Zhao Wei said. "They are only a few weeks old. When they have lived 15 months, then they will be ready to choose, and the boys will be older."
Lawrence halted in surprise, and turned to stare at the little hatchlings again.
He had always heard that dragons had to be tamed directly at hatching, to keep them from becoming feral and escaping into the wild, but this seemed plainly contradicted by the Chinese example. Temeraire said,
"It must be very lonely. I would not have liked to be without Lawrence when I hatched, at all."
He lowered his head and nudged Lawrence with his nose.
"And it would also be very tiresome to have to hunt all the time for yourself when you are first hatched. I was always hungry," he added more prosaically. "Of course, the hatchlings do not have to hunt for themselves," Zhao Wei said. "They must study. There are dragons who tend the eggs and feed the young. That is much better than having a person do it. Otherwise a dragonette could not help but become attached before he was wise enough to properly judge the character and the virtues of his proposed companion."
This was a pointed remark indeed, and Lawrence answered it coolly.
"I suppose that may be a concern, if you have less regulation of how men are to be chosen for such an opportunity. Among us, of course, a man must ordinarily serve for many years in the corps before he can be considered worthy even to be presented to a hatchling. In such circumstances, it seems to me that an early attachment, such as you decry, may be instead the foundation of a lasting, deeper affection, more rewarding to both parties."
They continued on into the city proper, and now with a view of his surroundings from a more ordinary perspective than from the air, Lawrence was struck afresh by the great breadth of the streets, which seemed to almost have been designed with dragons in mind. They gave the city a feeling of spaciousness, altogether different from London, though the absolute number of people was, he guessed, nearly equal. Temeraire was here more staring than stared at. The populace of the capital were evidently used to the presence of the more exalted breeds, while he had never been out into a city before, and his head craned nearly in a loop around his own neck as he tried to look in three directions at once. Guards roughly pushed ordinary travellers out of the way of green sedan chairs, carrying mandarins on official duties. Along one broad way, a wedding procession, brilliant with scarlet and gold, were winding their shouting, clapping way through the streets, with musicians and spitting fireworks in their train, and the bride well concealed in a draped chair. A wealthy match, to judge by the elaborate proceedings. Occasional mules plodded along under cartloads, inured to the presence of the dragons, their hooves clopping along the stones. But Lawrence did not see any horses on the main avenues, nor carriages. Likely they could not be tamed to bear the presence of so many dragons. The air smelled quite differently, none of the sour, grassy stench of manure and horse piss inescapable in London, but instead the faintly sulphurous smell of dragon waste, more pronounced when the wind blew from the northeast. Lawrence suspected some larger cesspools lay in that quarter of the city. And everywhere, everywhere dragons. The blue ones, most common, were engaged in the widest variety of tasks. In addition to those Lawrence saw ferrying people about with their carrying harnesses, others bore loads of freight. But a sizable number also seemed to be travelling alone on more important business, wearing collars of varying colours, much like the different colours of the Mandarin's jewels. Zhao Wei confirmed that these were signifiers of rank, and the dragons so adorned members of the civil service.
"The Shenlong are like people. Some are clever, and some are lazy," he said, and added, to Lawrence's great interest, "many superior breeds have risen from the best of them, and the wisest may even be honoured with an imperial mating."
Dozens of other breeds also were to be seen, some with and others without human companions, engaged on many errands. Once two imperial dragons came by, going in the opposite direction, and inclined their heads to Temeraire politely as they passed. They were adorned with scarves of red silk, knotted and wrapped in chains of gold, and sewn all over with small pearls, very elegant, to which Temeraire gave a sidelong, covetous eye. They came shortly into a market district, the stores lavishly decorated with carving and gilt, and full of goods. Silks of glorious colour and texture, some of much finer quality than anything Lawrence had ever seen in London. Great skeins and wrapped yards of the plain blue cotton as yarn and cloth, in different grades of quality both by thickness and by the intensity of the dye. And porcelain, which in particular caught Lawrence's attention. Unlike his father, he was no connoisseur of the art, but the precision in the blue and white designs seemed also superior to those dishes which he had seen imported, and the coloured dishes particularly lovely.
"Temeraire, will you ask if he would take gold?" he asked.
Temeraire was peering into the shop with much interest, while the merchant eyed his looming head in the doorway anxiously. This at least seemed one place, even in China, where dragons were not quite welcome. The merchant looked doubtful and addressed some questions to Zhao Wei. After this he consented at least to take a half guinea and inspect it. He wrapped it on the side of the table and then called in his son from a back room. Having few teeth left himself, he gave it to the younger man to bite upon. A woman seated in the back peeped around the corner, interested by the noise, and was admonished, loudly and without effect, until she stared her fill at Lawrence and withdrew again. But her voice came from the back room stridently, so she seemed also to be participating in the debate. At last the merchant seemed satisfied, but when Lawrence picked up the vase which he had been examining, he immediately jumped forward and took it away, with a torrent of words. Motioning Lawrence to stay, he went into the back room.
"He says that is not worth so much," Temeraire explained.
"But I have only given him half a pound," Lawrence protested.
The man came back, carrying a much larger vase in a deep, nearly glowing red, shading delicately to a pure white at the top, and with an almost mirrored gloss. He put it down on the table, and they all looked at it with admiration. Even Zhao Wei did not withhold a murmur of approval, and Temeraire said,
"Oh, that is very pretty."
Lawrence pressed another few guineas on the shopkeeper with some difficulty and still felt guilty at carrying it away, swathed in many protective layers of cotton rags. He had never seen a piece so lovely before, and he was already anxious for its survival through the long journey. Emboldened by this first success, he embarked on other purchases, of silk and other porcelain, and after that a small pendant of jade which Zhao Wei, his facade of disdain, gradually yielding to enthusiasm for the shopping expedition, pointed out to him, explaining that the symbols upon it were the start of the poem about the legendary woman dragon soldier. It was apparently a good luck symbol, often bought for a girl about to embark upon such a career. Lawrence rather thought Jane Roland would like it, and added it to the growing pile. Very soon Zhao Wei had to detail several of his soldiers to carry the various packages. They no longer seemed so concerned about Lawrence's potential escape as about his loading them down like cart horses. Prices for many of the goods seemed considerably lower than Lawrence was used to, in general, more than could be accounted for by the cost of freight. This alone was not a surprise, after hearing the company commissioners in Macau talk about the rapacity of the local mandarins and the bribes they demanded on top of the state duties. But the difference was so high that Lawrence had to revise significantly upwards his guesses of the degree of extortion.
"It is a great pity," Lawrence said to Temeraire as they came to the end of the avenue, If only the trade were allowed to proceed openly, I suppose these merchants could make a much better living, and the craftsmen too. Having to send all their wares through Canton is what allows the mandarins there to be so unreasonable. Probably they do not even want to bother if they can sell the goods here, so we receive only the dregs of their market.
Perhaps they do not want to sell the nicest pieces so far away. That is a very pleasant smell,
Temere said approvingly, as they crossed a small bridge into another district, surrounded by a narrow moat of water and a low stone wall. Open, shallow trenches full of smouldering coals lined the street to either side, with animals cooking over them, spitted on metal spears and being basted with great swabs by sweating, half-naked men. Oxen, pigs, sheep, deer, horses, and smaller, less identifiable creatures. Lawrence did not look very closely. The sauces dripped and scorched upon the stones, raising thick, wafting clouds of aromatic smoke. Only a handful of people were buying here, nimbly dodging among the dragons who made up the better part of the clientele. Temeraire had eaten heartily that morning, a couple of young venison with some stuffed ducks as a relish. He did not ask to eat, but looked a little wistfully at a smaller purple dragon eating roast suckling pigs off a skewer. But down a smaller alley, Lawrence also saw a tired-looking blue dragon, his hide marked with old sores from the silk carrying harness he wore, turning sadly away from a beautifully roasted cow, and pointing instead at a small, rather burnt sheep left off to the side. He took it away to a corner and began eating it very slowly, stretching it out, and he did not disdain the offal or the bones. It was natural that if dragons were expected to earn their bread, there should be some less fortunate than others, but Lawrence felt it somehow criminal to see one going hungry, particularly when there was so much extravagant waste at their residence and elsewhere. Temeraire did not notice, his gaze fixed on the displays. They came out of the district over another small bridge which led them back onto the broad avenue where they had begun. Temeraire sighed deeply with pleasure, releasing the aroma only slowly from his nostrils. Lawrence, for his part, was fallen quiet. The sight had dispelled his natural fascination with all the novelty of their surroundings and the natural interest inherent in a foreign capital of such extents, and without such distraction he was inescapably forced to recognise the stark contrast in the treatment of dragons. The city streets were not wider than in London by some odd coincidence, or a question of taste, or even for the greater grandeur which they offered, but plainly designed that dragons might live in full harmony with men, and that this design was accomplished to the benefit of all parties he could not dispute. The case of misery which he had seen served rather to illustrate the general good. The dinner hour was hard upon them, and Zhao Wei turned their route back towards the island. Temeraire also grown quieter as they left the market precincts behind, and they walked along in silence until they reached the gateway. There, pausing, he looked back over his shoulder at the city, its activity undiminished. Zhao Wei caught the look and said something to him in Chinese.
"It is very nice," Temeraire answered him, and added, "but I cannot compare it. I have never walked in London, or even in Dover."
They took their leave from Zhao Wei briefly outside the pavilion and went in again together. Lawrence sat heavily down upon a wooden bench, while Temeraire began to pace restlessly back and forth, his tail tip switching back and forth with agitation.
"It is not true at all," he burst out at last. "Lawrence, we have gone everywhere we liked. I have been in the streets and to shops, and no one has run away or been frightened, not in the south and not here. People are not afraid of dragons, not in the least."
"I must beg your pardon," Lawrence said quietly. "I confess I was mistaken. Plainly, men can be accustomed. I expect, with so many dragons about, all men here are raised with close experience of them and lose their fear. But I assure you I have not lied to you deliberately. The same is not true in Britain. It must be a question of use."
"If use can make men stop being afraid, I do not see why we should be kept penned up so they may continue to be frightened," Temeraire said.
To this Lawrence could make no answer, and did not try. Instead he retreated to his own room to take a little dinner. Temeraire lay down for his customary afternoon nap in a brooding, restless coil, while Lawrence sat alone, picking unenthusiastically over his plate.
Hammond came to inquire after what they had seen. Lawrence answered him as briefly as he could, his irritation of spirit ill-concealed, and in short order Hammond went away rather flushed and thin-lipped.
"Has that fellow been pestering you?"
Granby said, looking in.
"No,"
Lawrence said tiredly, getting up to rinse his hands in the basin he had filled from the pond.
"Indeed, I am afraid I was plainly rude to him just now, and he did not deserve it in the least. He was only curious how they raise the dragons here, so he could argue with them that Temeraire's treatment in England has not been so ill."
"Well, as far as I'm concerned, he deserved a trimming," Granby said. "I could have pulled out my hair when I woke up, and he told me, smug as a deacon, that he had packed you off alone with some Chinamen. Not that Temeraire would let any harm come to you, but anything could happen in a crowd, after all."
"No, nothing of the kind was attempted at all. Our guide was a little rude to begin, but perfectly civil by the end."
Lawrence glanced over at the bundles stacked in the corner where Zhao Wei's men had left them.
"I begin to think Hammond was right, John, and it was all old maid flutters and imagination," he said unhappily.
It seemed to him, after the long day's tour, that the prince hardly needed to stoop to murder, with the many advantages of his country to serve as gentler and no less persuasive arguments.
"More likely Yong Xing gave up trying aboard ship, and has just been waiting to get you settled in under his eyes,"
Granby said pessimistically.
"This is a nice enough cottage, I suppose, but there are a damned lot of guards skulking about."
"All the more reason not to fear," Lawrence said. "If they meant to kill me, they could have done so by now, a dozen times over.
Temeraire would hardly stay here if the Emperor's own guards killed you, and him already suspicious,"
Granby said.
"Most like he would do his best to kill the lot of them, and then, I hope, find the ship again and go back home, though it takes them very hard losing a captain, and he might just as easily go and run into the wild."
"We can argue ourselves in circles this way forever."
Lawrence lifted his hands impatiently, and let them drop again. "At least today, the only wish which I saw put in action was to make a desirable impression upon Temeraire." He did not say that this goal had been thoroughly accomplished and with little effort. He did not know how to draw a contrast against the treatment of dragons in the West without sounding at best a complainer and at worst nearly disloyal. He was conscious, afresh, that he had not been raised an aviator, and he was unwilling to say anything that might wound Granby's feelings.
"You are a damned sight too quiet,"
Granby said unexpectedly, and Lawrence gave a guilty start. He had been sitting and brooding in silence.
"I am not surprised he took a liking to the city. He is always on fire for anything new. But is it that bad?"
"It is not only the city," Lawrence said finally. "It is the respect which is given to dragons, and not only to himself. They all of them have a great deal of liberty, as a matter of course. I think I saw 100 dragons at least today, wandering through the streets, and no one took any notice of them."
"And God forbid we should take a flight over Regent's Park, but we have shrieks of murder and fire and flood all at once, and 10 memoranda sent us from the Admiralty,"
Granby agreed, with a quick flash of resentment.
"Not that we could set down in London if we wanted to. The streets are too narrow for anything bigger than a Winchester. From what we have seen, even just from the air, this place is laid out with a good deal more sense. It is no wonder they have 10 beasts to our 1, if not more."
Lawrence was deeply relieved to find Granby taking no offence against him, and so willing to discuss the subject.
"John, do you know, here they do not assign handlers until the dragon is 15 months of age. Until then they are raised by other dragons."
"Well, that seems a rotten waste to me, letting dragons sit around nurse-maiding," Granby said. "But I suppose they can afford it. Lawrence, when I think what we could do with a round dozen of those big scarlet fellows that they have sitting around getting fat everywhere, it makes you weep."
"Yes. But what I meant to say was, they seem not to have any ferals at all," Lawrence said. "Is it not 1 in 10 that we lose?"
"Oh, not nearly so many, not in modern times," Granby said. "We used to lose longwings by the dozen, until Queen Elizabeth had the bright idea of setting her serving-maid to one, and we found they would take to girls like lambs. And then it turned out the Zenikers would, too. And Winchesters often used to nip off like lightning before you could get a stitch of harness on them. But nowadays we hatch them inside and let them flap about for a bit before bringing out the food. Not more than 1 in 30 at the most, if you do not count the eggs we lose in the breeding-grounds. The ferals already there hide them from us sometimes."
Their conversation was interrupted by a servant. Lawrence tried to wave the man away, but with apologetic bows and a tug on Lawrence's sleeve, he made clear he wished to lead them out to the main dining chamber. Sun Kai, unexpectedly, had come to take tea with them.